Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
The Drive Nation podcast with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel.
For maybe the first time on the Drive Nation podcast, we're getting technical. It doesn't necessarily come naturally to Andrew and me, but we'll give it a go anyway. I'm not talking about car mechanics getting your fingers oily underneath the bonnet of a car. We're talking more about the engineering side. Having said that, neither of us are engineers. Andrew, there are writers in this industry who are super hot on engineering matters. I'm not one of them. Where do you sort of position yourself on that?
I'm the sort of bloke who looks at his television and sort of doesn't need to know how it works, just to be very grateful for the fact that it does. Yeah, no, I've got mates. There's a bloke called John Simister, who many people listening to this would have read his words over the years. And he just doesn't understand why I find it difficult. And we'll be sharing a car and he will be talking about, I don't know, some differential that he's just rebuilt, and he'll be talking about sun gear and planet wheels and all this stuff, and looking at me as if, you know, how could I possibly do my job if I didn't know all this stuff? I'm in awe of these characters, and I wish that I could. I mean, but to be honest with you, what could I do? I can change brake pads, I can change oil, I can change spark plugs. That's about it, I'm afraid, which is rather pathetic. But I guess what I'm kind of hoping we're going to be talking about is not so much how things work, but what effect those things have on the cars that we drive. Because if it is about how things work, then you're going to need to find somebody else to do this podcast for you, because I haven't got a clue.
Yeah, well, you and me both. I'm not particularly hot on the mechanics or the specifics, the details of car engineering. But I think anyone who writes about cars the way you and I do have a sort of duty, don't we, to at least make an effort to understand the fundamentals, the basics. We don't have to be able to tell anyone how to repair a broken whatever, but I think we do need to understand why a car does or doesn't, for instance, have a limited slip differential.
Yeah, no, I think it's very important. You know, you and I joke about how limited our engineering knowledge is, and it really is. But I hope what we are, without wishing to sound boastful, I hope what we're quite good at is, although we don't know how this stuff works, we do know absolutely the effect it has on the cars that we drive. And if you couldn't do that, you couldn't do this job, or you certainly couldn't do it very well. So, I mean, hopefully that's what we're going to be able to shed some light on. And also, I hope when people are about to sort of tick expensive boxes on options list, maybe inform them a little bit as to whether it's a good idea or not. Because, I mean, there is an awful lot of stuff which, depending on the sort of car you're going to buy, and particularly the sort of way you're going to use it, you can end up spending a lot of money on a lot of kit that you just don't need. Now, you might want to have it anyway because you think it's cool, and that's fine. But if we can, you know, provide a little bit of insight into what these things do and whether you need them or not, I think that might actually be us providing some kind of little public service there.
Yeah, we'll give it a go. We'll come on to that stuff a bit later on. I suspect, like me, Andrew, you, almost as a bare minimum, you try to educate yourself on vehicle dynamics, the sort of fundaments of how a car gets down a road or around a corner. And I'm talking about, you know, you'll have read Mark Donohue's book, The Unfair Advantage.
Indeed.
And I suspect learnt a huge amount just from that book alone.
Yeah, I mean, it's if nobody's read it, it's basically, it's his, Mark Donohue, amazing racing driver, American, very sadly died in 1975 in a crash in a Formula One race, the Austrian Grand Prix, in fact. But before that, he was just a complete legend in Can-Am cars and Indy cars and Trans Am cars and all. He basically raced everything. And his autobiography sort of took the form of basically being technical descriptions of how the cars he drove. And it's absolutely fascinating, and particularly the things that they used to do to those cars to develop them and the tests they used to go through. I mean, for instance, they used to just drive a car around a circle, you know, a constant radius corner, round and round and round, with equipment on it, which would just show the amount of lateral G that it could generate. And back then, you know, if you did something to, you had a new tire or you did something to the suspension, you wanted to find out whether it had more grip or not, that's what you did. And in the road car arena, yeah, we have to have, you know, a good understanding of why a car is doing what it is doing, relative to other cars, which perhaps have, you know, alternative systems on them. So it is actually all really important stuff. And I quite enjoy that. And I think the other thing that I have found, I mean, one of the things I get to do these days, because I'm so bloody old, is I get to sort of, for want of a better phrase, mentor the young auto car road testers. And they come and, you know, and not just their road testers, but also, you know, anybody on the magazine who needs to go and write first drives. And they come down to me and we go out and spend some time on the roads. And, you know, and I explain things like, things that are really, really, I find, quite easy to understand, but quite difficult to explain. Things like steering feel and the difference between primary and secondary ride and all that sort of stuff, which, you know, sounds quite sort of, I don't know, sounds technical or not, but it is really important to a person's ability to understand a car and what it does.
Yeah, without it, you're trying to review a car almost blind, aren't you? It's kind of hopeless if you don't understand the basics of vehicle dynamics. I mean, the very, very basics of vehicle dynamics. You're a little bit stuffed, really.
You have to have the basic equipment, don't you? I mean, you know, a plumber without his or her spanners isn't going to, you know, mend many washing machines. And it's the same thing. There is just a sort of a slightly technical language. And even if you don't use it in what you write, you do have to have it to be able to understand what a car is saying to you when you drive it. And if you can't do that, you can't do the job. It is that simple.
Okay, so let's get stuck into it then. I think we should start with limited slip differentials. It's funny, isn't it? This is either going to be interesting to people or deathly boring. I'm sure we'll get some feedback and work out which one it is. Fundamentally, though, a limited slip differential. Well, let's go right back to the beginning. You can't bind, or you shouldn't really bind the wheels on an axle on either side together on a solid axle, because when you travel around a corner, the wheel on the inside will travel less distance than the wheel on the outside, and that wheel on the inside will grab and it will sort of scuff along the road, and it's uncomfortable and you'll wear the tire and it's just not very clever. So you need some sort of differential to allow that differential in speed. And that's normally an open differential. Most cars have an open differential, which is fine. That solves that basic problem. However, with an open differential, the torque will always follow the path of least resistance. And that means that if one wheel is unloaded because of weight transfer or it's on a less grippy surface, that wheel will spin up and all the torque will go to that wheel and it'll spin even more. That's when you get that one tire fire. And it's a good phrase, isn't it?
Yeah,
and
it is. It's excellent.
And that's no good at all. Because if you lose traction on one tyre, it's the whole axle has lost traction. And if you're the extreme sort of scenario is if you're parked on the, say, a muddy verge and you've got one wheel on dry tarmac, other on very wet mud, the car won't get going because that tyre on the very wet mud will just spin and spin. So to get over that, you need a limited slip differential, some sort. There are various types. Fundamentally, they stop the torque from following that path of least resistance and going just to one side. They sort of divide the torque so that even if one tyre is on a very, very low grip surface, you'll still get drive from that axle. And then when you talk about a performance car, there are many, many other benefits, things like much better drive away from a corner with less wastage. In a front-wheel drive car, you can actually put your foot down much earlier than you think is necessary or sensible, and the differential, the LSD, will bite and just drag the car away from the corner in this sort of most remarkable way that just helps you get away from a bend with real speed. Actually, there's an interesting little stat here. Quaife, and they make limited slip differentials, they reckon that in a front-wheel drive car, on a damp day around Alton Park, the difference in lap time is 3 seconds having an LSD compared to not having one, which gives some indication of how effective an LSD can be on circuit. 3 seconds is a huge amount, isn't it?
Huge amount. And you know, I actually, particularly for a front wide, obviously it depends on other factors like which particular car it is and power and that sort of thing. But I can actually believe that for a front wheel drive car around a wet circuit, like, oh, definitely.
Yeah, I remember I've spoken about it on this podcast before, driving that Vauxhall Corsa VXR Club Sport up the hill climb, Gersten Down. And it had a Drexler LSD, and it worked so effectively. I could just stand on the power almost the moment the car was turned in. And without it, that would have just caused the car to power understeer into a barrier somewhere. But with the diff, it would just drag the car up the hill, and it was remarkable. I think, you know, getting rid of that differential probably would have been equivalent to getting rid of 50 horsepower or something. It made all the difference in the world. There are various types of LSD, but sort of primarily you've got geared types, automatic torque biasing, ATB diffs, and they're sort of fit and forget. There's no wearing parts. And you've also got plate diffs with clutch packs, and they're sort of more extreme. They're motorsport style, take more maintenance. And there are sort of others as well, electronically controlled discs, which we'll get onto. Disadvantages of a differential. And this is one of the reasons that I want to bring up this topic, because there are manufacturers that insist that you just don't need them, particularly with modern ESC technologies, you just don't need them. And there are drawbacks. There's extra weight. In a rear drive car in particular, you can get more understeer on turn-in with the diff sort of effectively pushing the car forward. There's also a school of thought that says actually it's safer to not have one, because if you stand on the power in a very clumsy way in a rear drive car and there's no locking diff and one tyre spins up, that's actually safer than both spinning up, because you won't necessarily get a big oversteer moment. That's how one of the Alpine engineers explained to me why they went without, which I thought was quite interesting. Have you heard that before?
Yeah, I have. To me, the ideal is to not have a limited slip differential for the reasons that you explained. They do make cars understeer, and they do add weight to the car. But of course, there comes a stage where the car has so much torque to transmit that you need some kind of device to enable the car to do that. Now, a car like the A110, I would absolutely defend it not having a differential for two reasons. One is it's not that powerful. And secondly, it's mid-engine, so it has a lot of inherent traction. And so what you could do is you could go and fit an LSD into an A110, and on a very, very small number of occasions, you know, find that it does give you a little bit of additional traction. But what you're doing is you're adding weight at the end of the car you don't want to add weight to. You're making the car understeer on entry, which you don't want it to do. And you know better than anybody, because you've got one, that lovely balance that car has. And you're going to affect that. And so why would you if you didn't need to? Now, Lotus have almost always taken exactly the same view. And they've always had their cars with open differentials. And they say that if you have proper rear suspension geometry, you've got a mid-engine car, unless you're dealing with ridiculously powerful cars, you get a better, for want of a better word, purer handling car with just having an open differential. Now, you know, road testers don't like cars with open differentials, largely because it's those big skid shots, you know, beloved. They're impossible to do. I mean, you can get the tail out on using weight transference, but you can't keep it there, because the moment a car is oversteering with an open differential and you put your foot on the gas, it just spins it all away. You need a limited slip differential to enable you to maintain the drift. And if you can't do that, then, you know, you ain't going to be drifting. So, you know, that's one of the reasons that people who do what we do for a living there are certain people who will actually sort of sneer at cars like McLarens, who also take a very purist view over these sort of things, and to date at least have not fitted a proper mechanical limited slip differential into the cars, because they can't do big drifts in them. And, you know, fine, you know, I understand that's their point of view. It's, you know, it's fun. But the McLaren case is interesting, because those are obviously, I can't think of another car with anything like that amount of power which doesn't have a mechanically locking differential in it. But generally speaking, I would say an LSD is a device for fixing a problem. And if you ain't got that problem, you don't need that device.
Oh, that's nice. That's a nice pithy way of sort of summarising it, isn't it? So you presumably think that McLarens get away without having some sort of locker?
To be honest with you, no. I understand why they've gone down that road. And they do clever things with the way they electronically control it. I mean, obviously, you know, what you were talking about... a car which loses traction on one side and therefore not being able to move. Obviously, what you can do in the modern world is have an electronic brain look at that and think, that's not very good. We'll divert some torque to the other wheel, and then off you go. So, or what you'll do is you'll brake that wheel, which is spinning, until eventually the torque finds its way to the other one, and off you go. So you can mimic to an extent the effect in certain situations of a limited slip differential without having one, and McLaren has so far chosen to do that. At times, when McLaren start to oversteer, they can be. I mean, certainly the 765LT got some stick for this. It's not something that I experienced myself, but I know that you did. When it gets a bit spiky when the power is reapplied, and you don't get that very sort of progressive drift that you do if the car had a limited slip differential. So it's a long answer to a short question, isn't it? But I think that with cars like that, fundamentally they should have limited slip differentials in them. And being a bit of a purist, I don't really like the idea, but in reality, I think those cars would be better off even than they are if they'd had one fitted.
Yeah, there's a sort of ongoing conversation to be had about it, isn't there? And I suppose McLaren would say that that's all well and good, but it comes at a cost. And the extra weight, the extra understeer would actually make it not an improvement, which is perhaps fair enough. But there are electronically controlled limited slip differentials. And we're not talking e-diffs. We've mentioned those where you use the brakes to mimic the effect. These actually they're mechanical limited slip differentials, but they have electronic control so that the computer, the brain, can decide when it's open and when it's closed, when it's locked. That's how you get around that entry understeer issue. And you also have that very progressive type of breakaway under power that we all love. I mean, Ferraris have them. So you've done this. I know you have. You drive a modern Ferrari, say a 488 Pista. It's got one of these very clever, electronically controlled, but mechanical limited slip differentials. And it's such a controllable car at the limit, isn't it? It's it's actually incredible. I remember driving it thinking, this is a 700 plus horsepower mid-engine Ferrari, and it's as controllable at the limit as an M2 or something.
Yeah, I mean, it is extraordinary. And I think we should say at this stage with limited slip diffs, if people don't know, with a limited slip diff, you can choose the amount of slip that is limited. They have sort of lock-up ratios. The thing with an e-diff is that in theory, at least, it can go from being fully open to completely locked. So effectively, you have, if it's fully locked, you know, an equal amount of torque goes to both wheels. So it is, you know, on paper at least, the perfect solution. The reason that I suspect that McLaren has resisted it till now is that, you know, an e-diff is heavier than a limited slip diff, and a limited slip diff is heavier than an open diff. And, you know, McLaren being fairly weight obsessed, I don't think they have much liked the idea of adding that amount of mass to that end of the car. But it will be interesting to see. I think, as many people know, McLaren have got their sort of, you know, their new second generation car starting life in the spring. It's a replacement for the sports series, the 570S, and so on and so forth. And, you know, that's their kind of clean sheet design. And I will be very interested. I mean, I read in Autocar today that it's going to have, you know, at the get-go, over 600 horsepower. And that's going to be their sort of standard base offering, with a huge amount of electric hybrid torque as well. And I would just be interested to see whether they have continued to stick to their guns and keep that with an open diff, or whether they've actually got to the stage where they think, you know, do you know what? We've got so much torque to transmit, you know, actually having an open diff is causing more problems than it solves. And then I presume they go to an e-diff, but we will see. It'll be interesting.
Mm. Okay, one last word then on LSDs.
Yeah.
A really good candidate for an aftermarket LSD is a BMW M135i or M140i. So I'm talking the previous generation.
It sounds to me like you have some knowledge in this area.
A little bit. Yeah, so the previous car, the rear drive car with that lovely six-cylinder turbo engine, that's a really good candidate because BMW, I think you could get one through its in-house aftermarket catalogue, couldn't you? But they certainly, most cars did not come with LSDs. They had
no
open diffs.
Because they wanted to keep them for the M2 and that sort of thing, didn't they? Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And so there are companies that will offer them for sale. Quaife make them, and you can get them through companies like Birds. And I had an M135i for a little while, and we fitted one. We gave the car a load more power and we fitted a diff. I have spoken about it before in this podcast. And what I found was just much more, well, more traction, less sort of stability control interference in the corner exits, but also more predictable power oversteer, you know, that sort of more clinical, more progressive breakaway from the rear end under power. It just made the car way more fun to drive.
And it didn't spoil the balance. It didn't make it push too much.
I never drove it thinking, ooh, it feels a bit pushy now.
It's interesting.
I thought it was a really, really good upgrade. Partly because it's a front engine car. Okay, it's a BMW. They say it's 50-50 weight distribution, but even so, the engine's at the front, driven wheels at the back. It got plenty of torque. I think it's just a really strong candidate for an LSD upgrade, isn't it? Right, let's move on to something completely different then.
Just before you do, can I just do one last word on LSDs? I have been lucky enough to drive a few Group C cars, sort of, you know, sports cars, you know, Le Mans cars from the 1980s. And their solution to the traction issue was not to have a diff. They have a thing called a spool diff, which effectively means the axle is locked. Which means if you're sort of pushing them around the paddock and trying to negotiate them, I mean, they're absolute nightmares and they clank and they slip and they skid and they do everything else. But if you don't have a diff, the traction that you get, you just realise just how much you're losing when you do. So I just thought I'd lob that in there because, well, I can.
Yeah, you can. And yeah. Drifters do it as well, don't they? They just weld their diffs
exactly.
up and it's basically the same thing. Okay, let's talk about carbon ceramic brakes.
Ooh.
And this is a good one to get into because if you want to specify carbon ceramic brakes on your new Porsche or whatever, Aston Martin, whatever it is, you're spending $5,000, maybe $10,000.
Yeah.
It's such a lot of money, isn't it?
Yeah.
Let's think back to the early days of them. I think the Porsche GT2 was, if not the first production road car to have them, one of them at least, one of the first. What do you remember of the brakes on that car?
They did a good job of stopping the car, they were a bit fraught. I mean, my fear for them was that they wouldn't work outside a certain temperature window, and that you'd get in the car first thing in the morning on a cold day, and you wouldn't have any brakes. Now, clearly, Porsche weren't going to put a car like that into production, so they did work well enough. They just didn't feel right. And you know, I'm one of these guys who, I always think a car has a really good brake system if you can drive from one place to another and never think about it. If your brakes are giving you cause for thought, it's almost always because they're not behaving the way that you want them to. Maybe the pedal feel is rubbish, maybe they're starting to fade, maybe the pedal progression is rubbish, whatever. And the problem with those early carbon ceramic brakes is you just didn't get the pedal feel that you got with iron discs. And I would say that even now, and there aren't that many cars you can drive these days where you can sort of chop from one to the other, but you know, the 911 is absolutely one. I would say that if you want, you know, if you're not going to be skidding around tracks or whatever, if you just want the car with the best brake feel, definitely still go for, save yourself the money and still go for iron discs.
Yeah, I 5 years ago at Evo magazine, I did a test, a direct back-to-back comparison of the upgraded carbon ceramic brakes, which I can't remember the cost of them on that car, but it must have been $6,000 or $7,000. $6,000 or $7,000.
I know. I mean, but they do last forever, don't they? I mean, they do. Yeah. You do. So you're not going to. You probably won't replace them. But yeah, sorry, do go on.
And so we used identical Jaguar F-Type Rs, the V8 ones. They were otherwise identical, but one car had the standard iron brakes, the other car had the upgraded carbon ceramics. And we had to devise a test to try and tease out actually what the manifest difference was between those two braking systems. And we worked out that we actually had to make it a really extreme test, otherwise we wouldn't really be able to demonstrate any difference at all. And so what we did was, in each car, we did 20 consecutive emergency stops from 100 miles an hour with only as long as it took to accelerate back up to 100 miles an hour, that time to let them cool down again. So it was a really quite brutal test, actually. I remember saying to Jaguar, we're going to do this test and it's going to be over many pages, you'll get great coverage, but we need to do it on the understanding that we might destroy a set of brakes. And
I bet you did.
Well, we gave it a good go, and they didn't look good afterwards, particularly the iron ones, you know, when the pad sort of smears around the disc, and it looks horrible, and it doesn't feel quite right after that either. I remember which was handy for the photos, I remember the discs, the iron discs glowing bright red. I remember the pads were on fire at one point and just having to disappear for a lap around the circuit just to try and get some air running over the brakes, just to try and cool them down a little bit. I hated doing it, actually, because it just felt like torture to the car. But, you know, it was in the name of science. So there we go. I could justify it to myself. So we did that 20 consecutive emergency stops from 100 miles an hour. And the results, I think, were quite interesting. The carbon ceramic brakes didn't fade, in the sense that the braking distance almost didn't increase at all from, you know, the first run to the 20th run. Whereas the iron brakes, the first run, the car stopped in 87 metres, and the last one, it stopped in 112 metres.
Oh.
So quite a big increase there. That demonstrated what the difference is between those two braking systems. So, you know, I think we proved that they work as advertised.
But nobody's ever going to do that in the real world, are they?
That's the thing. That is the thing. And if you would never even do that on the circuit,
exactly.
Torture brakes like that. You would never do that. And there are, you know, there are other factors as well that we have to address now. There's an unsprung weight saving, isn't there, with carbon ceramic brakes? Quite a big one, in fact.
Yeah, and many kilos per corner.
Yeah, and a chassis, a ride and handling engineer will tell you that that weight saving at each corner, that unsprung weight saving, is like gold dust. They'd kill to have it because of the advantages it confers, particularly in terms of ride. There are other sort of minor differences. You get less brake dust from ceramics.
If you leave them for a long time outside in winter and wet weather, they haven't welded themselves to their brake pads.
So there we go. I mean, you've already said, haven't you, that you basically don't think they're worth it, even if you're going to do
I wouldn't say that. I think it depends on two crucial things. One is how good are the standard iron brakes.
Now, yeah, okay.
Historically speaking, I've not been knocked out by Jaguar brakes on tracks. They have tended to disappear quite quickly. So, you know, if you were going to be doing lots of track days in your Jaguar, which you probably wouldn't be, but maybe you were, then, you know, it's worth looking at. You know, that said, I did a day at Anglesey with a 992 last year, which had iron brakes, and they didn't go away once. You know, they were just, you know, and there are some big brakes, you know, big braking moments you need at Anglesey. And the brakes on that 992 were, you know, as good on the last lap as they had been on the first. And I can remember sitting there thinking to myself, well, why would you go to the extra cost of, you know, fitting the carbon ceramics when these brakes feel so good? And actually, even, you know, on a dry track, being subjected to some fairly extreme treatment by a bunch of lunatics, we still couldn't fault them. The other thing I would say is that even with them, with the world of ceramic brakes, there are, you know, there are carbon ceramic brakes and there are carbon ceramic brakes, and, you know, and you know, just because you've got them, you're not immune. It doesn't mean that they will never ever fade. You know, if you treat a car hard enough, you know, the brakes, I mean, I was driving a Manti Racing GT3 RS quite recently at Silverstone, deliberately driving it as hard and as fast as I possibly could, and the brakes got a bit stressy. Despite the fact that they were, you know, Porsche standard carbon ceramics. So, you know, the different uses, different tracks, different, you know, all sorts of things. So what I would say is do your research and, you know, don't spend the money unless you absolutely have to. But if you're basically going to be doing a lot of track days, then I guess for most cars, they are worth it. The rest of the time, you know, I'd seriously consider staying with whatever standard.
Yeah, and also with the standard standard iron brakes, you can, of course, improve them if you're doing track work with uprated pads, with better brake fluid, and that stuff can really make a huge difference.
Yes, indeed.
Back to carbon ceramics, the brake pedal feel, cold weather performance, that's all improved hugely.
Massively. Yeah. I mean, I certainly wouldn't rule out carbon ceramics because of that anymore.
No.
You know, I've got into cars with carbon ceramic brakes when it's been minus plenty, and they just work from the get go. They're very, very clever like that.
What do we reckon then to air suspension? Lots of quite high end cars have an air suspension option.
Yeah.
Actually, the Audi RS6 comes on air as standard, and you can optionally upgrade to coil springs. Where do you stand on them? I mean, do you think if it's a luxury car, they're often worth having or not? Or
completely. It's so car dependent. You know, I don't think you can make a limo ride like a limo unless it's on air. Or I certainly haven't driven one that. I mean, they all are these days. You know, even if you just do things like, I don't know if they still do it, but like, you know, an E-Class Mercedes, if you buy the saloon as standard, it comes with steel springs at both ends. But if you get the wagon, you get air at the back because they want the self-leveling for load control. And they just ride better. A car like an E-Class or an S-Class on full air all round, it makes such a difference. It really does. If that's what you want from your car, I mean, there's all sorts of disadvantages to air suspension. Obviously, the cost, and they are very heavy, and they don't work well at all on racetracks. So, you know, for that kind of car, you certainly wouldn't consider them. That's why I guess with something like the RS6, Audi allows you to upgrade to what for them will almost certainly be a cheaper system. But I guess it's like carbon brakes, isn't it? In the right environment, they're better than anything else. But if that's not important to you, or that's not going to be the way you use your car, I wouldn't bother.
I think it's good that we're discussing this stuff, because quite often, yeah, you know, if you've not read up much about carbon ceramic brakes or air suspension, and you're speccing a car, and the dealer's telling you that, yeah, air suspension, it will make it much more comfortable. You need carbon brakes because they're much more fade resistant or whatever. How do you know? How do you know if you're just being sold or if it's really worthwhile? You're right about air suspension. Just like with carbon brakes, it's sort of car dependent, isn't it? And also usage dependent. Do you think, though, that with air springs, we know that they typically improve ride quality? But is there a school of thought that says over certain imperfections in the road,
yes,
like
absolutely,
an expansion joint, they sort of slap, don't they?
Yeah, they do. And particularly around town. Air suspension works better the faster you go, which is why they're great. They're such great. Cars with air are such great long distance cars, because if you're sitting on motorways, they're really very good at that sort of thing. But if you're just, you know, on slightly nedgy roads, you know, in and out of town, that sort of thing, doing 20, 30 miles an hour, they actually can struggle. And if I was, you know, a proper engineer, I'd be able to tell you why they do. But they just do. I suspect it's because they are big units, and they probably need quite a lot of input for them to work properly. And if you're not traveling fast, if you're not actually putting a lot of load through the suspension, you're probably not within their operating window. Now, I know they've got a lot better in recent years, and people now have these, you know, three chamber air springs, and the issues are certainly nothing like what they used to be. But yeah, again, you know, these things, you know, it's like LSDs. There's no such, you know, there's very rarely anything you can point to and go, yeah, get one of that, because there are no downsides. You know, whatever you put on a car, it's going to cost money if it's optional. It's almost certainly, well, I suppose, you know, carbon brakes won't, but most things add weight too. And there will be other downsides too. So it's very, very rarely a case of, oh yeah, absolutely, yeah, just get that. It's much more a case of, well, you know, what does it cost? How are you going to use the car? What are the disadvantages as well? And you've got to look at this thing, you know, from 360 degrees, because otherwise, you know, what will happen, because this is what obviously dealers want you to do, is you end up spending an awful lot of money, very little of which you'll get back at resale time, putting stuff on your cars, which at best won't improve it in the way that you use it, and at other times can genuinely make them worse.
And much more expensive. Now, talking of which, where's your closest OPC? Probably Bristol, isn't it? Official Porsche Centre. You're at Porsche Bristol. You are speccing a 992 Carrera S. You're having a Carrera. Hang on, which one's going to have the manual? The Carrera S is going to be offered with a manual, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, so you're having an S and you're having a manual.
Yes, please.
And are you having rear wheel steering?
Yes, I am.
Interesting.
Yes, I am.
Right, you're going to have to make a case for it now, because I'm not.
Okay, so I paused then, okay, because, I mean, if you were talking about a luxury car or a big SUV or something, anything with a long wheelbase, yeah, then to me, rear wheel steering is a no-brainer, because the additional mass is neither here nor there in something which already weighs 2 tons, and its ability to shorten the wheelbase effectively when you're parking the thing or manoeuvring around town, and then also effectively extend it at high speeds when you're on motorways and that sort of thing, I think it's a complete no-brainer. In something like a 992, I actually had it on a 991 that I ran for a bit, and I just felt it made the car feel a bit sharper. I'm not saying that in any way it's an absolutely essential, you have to have rear wheel steering, and that's why I paused when I really had to think about it. On balance, I would, because I think it just makes the car a bit more incisive on a decent road. But to me, not having it would be no kind of deal breaker at all. But you clearly wouldn't.
Well, I just prefer... I think 911s are at their best simpler, particularly Carreras, you know. I like them simple. I like nothing on them, really. I don't want any active anti-roll bars or any of that stuff. I just want it as simple as I can get it. Yeah, that means not having rear steering. I want to get stuck into this a little bit because many of us, people who write and talk about cars, are guilty of this quite often, I think. We talk about rear wheel steering, and we all know that there's a crossover point where the rear wheels, rather than turning in the opposite direction to the fronts, turn in the same direction as the fronts. And that's usually, 30-something miles an hour, isn't it? And the idea being that you make the car effectively... Well, you make it more agile at very low speeds by making its wheelbase effectively shorter. And then at higher speeds, over 30 miles an hour, whatever the crossover point is, you make it more stable with an effectively longer wheelbase, which is fine. That makes sense. But then that means that when you're driving at 60 miles an hour along a good B road, the rear wheels are turning in the same direction as the fronts, and your car is therefore less agile than it might otherwise have been. And why is that an advantage?
Oh, that's a question, isn't it? why is that an advantage? Well, I mean, it depends, doesn't it? You know, for people like you or me, then you probably see that as a disadvantage. But I suspect for your average 992 user, the idea of a 911 being more rather than less stable is probably quite appealing. I think that what is right for some people isn't necessarily right for others. It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I don't know particularly the speeds at which the Porsche system cuts in and out. And, you know, I would back them sufficiently to think that they've thought of these sorts of things. I have just preferred it it's a very, very subjective judgment. I completely, you know, understand and respect your point of view.
I believe it was a Porsche engineer who explained it to me this way. The point about making a car more stable at higher speeds is that you can therefore give it a more direct steering ratio. If you've got a very direct steering ratio with a less stable rear end, the car's going to be undrivable. Yeah. But if you make that rear end more stable by turning the wheels in the same direction as the fronts, you can then offset that by giving it a much more direct steering ratio, and you therefore have what feels like a more agile car. So it's a weird sort of counterintuitive thing, but you know, these things are never quite as simple as advertised, are they?
No, they're not. And I fundamentally don't like the idea. I don't like quick racks on cars, and I never have. And actually, I've always admired companies like Porsche and McLaren, who've always resisted, and Lotus as well, the urge to put really quick racks on cars. Because if you put... And what I mean by a quick rack is that, you know, there is, you know, a large amount of deflection for any given input into the steering, which can make a car feel superficially sporty. I mean, Ferraris were really guilty of this. So they're getting better now. But about 10 years ago, they would just feel super aggressive. And I'd find they'd knock my confidence. And, you know, you just wouldn't feel as comfortable driving the car. So... You know, I'd just rather, you know, I don't mind cars with, you know, medium to slow racks. I don't need cars to feel super twitchy off centre. I just want them to feel linear. What I sort of feel about it.
Right, let's cover off one more area, one more topic. Active anti-roll bars. We've spoken about these before in the context of a 911, haven't we? And I think we've both said that we wouldn't specify Porsche Dynamic Chassis Control active anti-roll bars. Yeah, because they work. They're there to take body roll out of the car in corners, but you don't want that because it's body roll that allows you to feel the car loading up, feel the grip down the side of the car. But they have their use, don't they, particularly in luxury cars?
They do, yeah. I mean, certainly on the Porsche, I think I probably said on this podcast once, that 991 I've just referred to had active roll bars on it. And I think I probably pressed the button twice in my life. I didn't even prefer it with the active roll bars working on a track, let alone on the road. All they seem to do is just completely trash the ride. And on the track, as I say, I just preferred, it probably was slightly slower, but who cares? I just preferred the more natural feel of the roll bars being able to do, you know, what they would normally do. With luxury cars, Yeah, they do make a bit of a difference, I guess. But I don't think I've ever driven one where I've suddenly thought that these were, you know, game changing things. To be honest with you, I'm just not. I mean, I know that engineers love them because, you know, they can make a car corner completely level and that sort of thing. But yeah, I'm not. I mean, I think where they are really good is when you've got these 48 volt systems on things like, I can remember driving a Bentley Bentayga. Not that anybody's ever going to go off-roading one of these things, but that has the ability to alter its roll bars from basically effectively no give in them at all, so like 100% locked, to effectively uncoupled. So effectively the car has no roll bars on it at all. So, you know, where you want to track, you'd have no roll whatsoever. Where you're going off-road, you know, the wheels would be allowed to flop around to their heart's content. And that's a clever and useful thing in a car like that, if you're going to use it for those purposes. But I can't imagine anyone using their Bentayga either off-road or on a track, let alone both.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. It's being, in a luxury car in particular, it's being able to decouple the roll bar, isn't it, as you're travelling just along a straight road, and allowing the wheels on either side of each axle to rise up and down and therefore settle the ride quality. Okay, well, let's leave it there for all the technical stuff, mostly because I suspect you and I have exhausted every ounce of our knowledge we have on the subject matter.
We haven't done suspension yet. Not that I should. Maybe we'll come back to that another time. I could do 10 minutes on the McPherson strut, but I'm not going to.
All right.
Let's do that another time. I want to talk about Lewis.
Well, okay. Well, yeah, we will come back to suspension arrangements another time because I want to talk about the Alpine A110 again. But yeah, let's talk about Lewis. So we're recording this the day after Lewis Hamilton won his 92nd Formula One Grand Prix, therefore breaking the record that he equaled last week, wasn't it, or week before. This has only happened a handful of times in the history of the sport, hasn't it? So it's a big, big moment.
It is a big, big moment. And yeah, it's an extraordinary achievement. And I think what is amazing about it is, you know, he's clearly got so many more in him. I mean, he could go way into three figures. I mean, if he retired his bat at 120 wins, that wouldn't surprise me at all. And okay, everybody said after Michael got 91 that nobody could ever imagine anyone touching that, and Lewis has obviously done that. But you know, I don't know of active Formula One drivers who's second. It would presumably be Sebastian or someone like that, but you know, he's clearly not going to do it. So you know, you're going to be looking at someone starting from scratch, and I'm not sure that I will live long enough to see anyone beat Lewis's record. It is the most extraordinary achievement. And I know that there are people out there who will knock Lewis and always say, oh, well, he's always had the best car, and he has. But, you know, he's one of the reasons that that car is as good as it is. And particularly Michael was like that. You know, that Ferrari, you know, he went to Ferrari in 1996 and the car was an absolute mutt. And he worked harder, I think, than, you know, any driver has any worked, has ever worked, to bring that team along with him. He built the team around him and created a series of simply, or helped create a series of simply extraordinary racing cars. And I think that the talismanic effect of having Lewis in your team, someone who will drive that hard and race that hard and is as intelligent as he is, you know, I think, you know, he makes a lot of his own success when he's outside the cockpit. So, you know, all the credit in the world to him. I think it is an amazing performance. And I guess, you know, I did something on Drive Nation yesterday, pointed to some research in The Economist, which tried to address the age-old issue of who's the best ever. And I've always thought it's a slightly pointless argument, although interesting. And I was very interested by the way they tried to use, you know, computer modelling to work it out once and for all. But to me, you just can't compare drivers from one era to another, and I mean that you couldn't even compare Lewis to someone like Senna, let alone, you know, Fangio or Jim Clark. I think all you can say is that one driver is the best of his era, and to me, Lewis is head, shoulders, you know, knees and toes above anybody else out there.
Yeah, that's true. He's also by the end of the season, he is going to win a seventh world title, and that does make him statistically the greatest. Statistically, and that's a very important distinction to make.
Well, he will equal Michael's number of world titles,
but then also have more race wins.
Absolutely right. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was having a Twitter conversation a while ago about this stuff, and it was Matt Bishop, who was editor of the F1 Mag a while ago, wasn't he? And yes. McLaren's comms guy.
Yes.
And he said very astutely, very wisely, you know, trying to draw these statistical comparisons across the generations is pointless. And I can't remember his exact phrase, but he said, the only way we can hope to get anywhere near it is through ongoing, flawed, lyrical debate. And that's great, isn't it? We can't prove it with numbers. We can't.
No, you can't.
You have to come up with some formula. We just have to talk about it and discuss it. And
to me, the ultimate example of that is that, you know, you could get, you know, all the computers of the world to do all the number crunching in the world, and none of them would ever put Sterling in the top 10 of anything.
There we go.
Whereas I think that, you know, okay, I mean, I would say this, wouldn't I? But I think most people coming up with their list of the top 10 drivers of all time would have Sterling on it. And I think that probably most of them would have him quite a long way up there. But statistically, he's nowhere. It's an interesting conversation to have, and I love having the debate, but ultimately you can never just use raw data to say that one person was better than another, other than, you know, where there are direct comparisons to be made. And in Lewis's case, you can compare directly to the other people who are out there doing it at the same time as him. And among that lot, yeah, he's in a different league.
Right, I just want to say one thing. And you referenced it earlier. This criticism that Hamilton gets for having had the best car for the last, 6 years or whatever.
Yeah.
People say he only won the world championship that many times because he had the best car. And I hate that. It really frustrates me. The thing is, he had the best car and he won, okay? You can only level that criticism at the person who had the best car and didn't win. You know, that's they have a case to answer. It's Bottas. Yeah. Bottas has got the best car and he doesn't win. So you can level that criticism at him. You can't level it at the guy who also did win.
Yeah, and also he's not always had the best car. You know, the Ferrari, you know, was a couple of seasons back, was a better car. And level that criticism at Vettel for somehow allowing Mercedes to do because it's not just the car, is it? It's teamwork and it's everything else, and they did a better job. So absolutely. Cream always rises to the top and they find a way. I just think Lewis has done a spectacular job. And I hope it's a bit boring for people because, you know, Mercedes always wins and Lewis almost always wins when Mercedes wins. And nobody would like more competitive racing in Formula One more than I would. But, you know, you can't blame the drivers and you can't blame the cars for, you know, blame the rule makers. It's what that team has achieved over the years, particularly with that driver, is awe-inspiring.
I can't remember exactly what Max Verstappen said yesterday, but it's a really interesting quote. And it basically revealed that one of Lewis's main motivations for racking up these race wins, racking up the titles, is that he wants to raise the bar as high as he can before retiring to make it as hard as possible for Max to beat him. Because it's really interesting, isn't it? Because he looks at Max, who is he 12 now or is he 13 years old? And he just sees that this kid has got, you know, maybe 15 more seasons ahead of him, whatever it is. And he reckons that with the talent he's got, he's the one who is going to potentially displace Hamilton's records. So it's fascinating that Lewis views it that way.
I think it's really unlikely, though. I think it's, you know, I just, Max has been around for quite a long time and he is absolutely a gifted driver. But, you know, are the stars going to align, in the way they did for Lewis? You know, Lewis, you know, was at McLaren. McLaren was super successful, and then went to Mercedes and had a not dissimilar experience then, which has gone on for even longer. I guess for every season that Lewis continues to succeed, A, the number gets higher, but also Max gets older, and it just, you know, it's a double whammy for him, isn't it? It just makes it even more difficult. But I mean, I don't know. I think Max would be doing extremely well to beat Lewis. Maybe he will, but my jury is very much still out on that.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary thing to witness, someone breaking all these records, but it doesn't make for great entertainment, does it? So frankly, I hope that nobody beats the records, because I just want Formula One to be more competitive from here on in.
Yeah, absolutely. And sadly, we've got next year with, you know, a rules freeze. So it will be, I can't think of any reason why it won't be the same again. But, and we've discussed this in another podcast, but hopefully when things do genuinely change in 2022, it will be, you know, a more interesting show than it is at the moment.
Yeah, I hope so. Okay, all right, let's wrap this one up. And I'll rattle off my calls to action. So please remember to review the podcast, leave a rating, subscribe to the podcast wherever you download them. And also please check out patreon.com/drivenation, where you can bung us a few quid a month, and you'll get some exclusive written stuff from the two of us in return. And thank you to everybody who has done so far.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you one and all. We'll be back again this time next week.
The Drive Nation podcast with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.